What's up, everybody? It's me, Sean, the most handsome guy on the podcast, calling in for episode 46. It's pretty low-key this week, and we talked about Ridge Retreat, which our annual retreat, fly 80 people in. It's a ton of fun, not to brag. We talk about brand awareness and if something you should be focusing on and how big the world is. We have a little panzerism in there. Just, you know, very solid episode. You can see why we're the number one podcast on earth. But thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading this episode 80,000 times to make us the number one podcast. I'll talk to everybody later. Thank you, Fulfill. Thank you, Sendlay. Thank you, Northbeam. Three softwares that I am intimately in love with. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Sean, tell us about this Ridge Retreat that you guys just did. It looked awesome. Looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, 80 plus people coming together in Vegas. So we had a lot of our US staff, a lot of our international staff. The goal is to do two a year. For the past 3 years, we've only ever pulled off one. Maybe this year we'll do two, but it's a lot of fucking work. You know, it costs about $250,000 to pull the thing off. And it's really just so people can bond with their coworkers and be friends. I'm a little under the weather because five nights in Vegas will do that to you. But Jason,
I mean, 250K for all those people doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, we just did this South Beach food and wine event, and that's a marketing event, obviously. It probably cost us 150K between sponsorship dollars and sending everyone there and logistics and stuff. Like, we drop 150K on an event like that. Boom. So that doesn't sound crazy to get your whole team together in Vegas.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have an amazing event staff. So Adam and Anna were in the whole thing, and Adam is like tenacious when it comes to budgets and protecting dollars. So I think the hotels were $60,000, and that is 80 rooms for five nights. You can only do that in Vegas. Like, that's an incredible.
I hope you didn't stay at like the Luxor or the Excalibur.
No. We stayed, basically the same type of tier. We stayed at Park MGM. So it's fine. Smoke free. We were supposed to be at the Nomad. They're nicer rooms, but they bumped us down. So that was like a battle back and forth. But Vegas is like one of the few places where you can actually like get everybody in for a pretty reasonable price. And then it's the flights. So it's 80 flights. A lot of people are flying internationally. So that gets pretty expensive. And then doing it in Vegas, you get the conference rooms like inside the hotel. It's super easy. And then it's just team building. Like, everyone went to the Sphere for a show. Everyone went to a Cirque du Soleil show. Everyone went to Nobu. Like, you just let them have as much fun as possible, because if you work with your people every day in person, you eventually hate some of your coworkers. But if you only see them for a week at a time and it's a vacation every time, you love your coworkers. You cannot wait to hang out with them again. So that's typically how we do it.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing some offsites. We haven't really done it yet, but like, our growth team we've added a lot of headcount in the growth team, and like Connor and Cameron in Denver, and Anna is in Philly, and Andrew is in Portland, and they all they'll come to LA, but we're just so distracted with so many other things being pulled in a million different directions that what I'd like to do is like a senior team offsite and some growth team offsite work to just really be able to focus down and not be interrupted all the time. I mean, yours is more like a fun thing, which I think is really valuable too. We do that for the Christmas party every year. Like, we throw a pretty fucking awesome holiday party and we let everyone fly in for that. And so those are pretty cool, but it's not the same as that, having that 3 or 4 days that you have of really intense bonding. What's the most fun, crazy thing you guys did?
Well, every year we give everybody some amount of cash to just go gamble with, try to like promote team bonding through winning or loss. But going back to what you talked about, yeah, you should definitely do like leadership meetups or department meetups. Those happen average 2 to 4 times a year, typically with the marketing one around a Meta event. So like, Meta throws events in San Francisco, you know, twice or 3 times a year. So most of the marketing team will fly up to meet up for one of those and get 2 days working in person together, like a lot of just grind time. And then the leadership meets up 2 to 4 times a year separately. But those are, you know, 10, 12, 20 people teams. Getting everybody together to party once a year, we found, is just like the quickest way to build trust amongst teams. And then the other big event we did was go-karting this year. So everyone went go-karting. And dude, we have some aggressive, competitive people at Ridge. Go-karting in Vegas, they're ramming into each other. They're drunk. They're passing each other. It was wild, I hear.
So you didn't go out and like shoot a bunch of guns?
No, some of the team, I mean, the last 2 days are just free days. So teams can just like pair up and go do whatever they want. Some people went hiking. Some people, you know, went thrift shopping. People talked about shooting guns, but nothing sponsored as the team. I think the takeaway for any CEO listening to this is, dude, it's so hard to do these because you're like, I had to give, you know, 3 hours of presentations, talking to everybody about like, what's our goal this year? Like, what are we working on? What's the team? Like that type of stuff. Like, what's the focus? And then you're probably the only person who knows everybody. So you're just a lot of conversations you have to have. And I love my team, but like, you know, after 5 days of like, my word count was probably 50,000 words a day or something crazy. Like I was just yapping it up for 5 days in a row.
Yeah, it's exhausting. It's so exhausting. I'm like, you know, when we do events and everyone wants to talk to you because you're the guy in charge. You know, Danny and I, we do these events and we're both like wiped. Our holiday party can't enjoy it. And so it takes a surprising toll. So I'm not surprised. Like you should be in bed right now.
Yeah. So I'm recovering, but anyway, really fun. Recommend doing it.
Well, speaking of events, we did this, we just launched this super cool new product, and I usually don't talk about our products, but I'm just like totally blown away by this thing. This is the Hexclad Pizza Steel. And we did an event last week with Nancy Silverton, who runs Osteria Mozza. I mean, she's a Michelin star chef, highly decorated. She's incredible. And that thing will change your life. If you like pizza, you need that thing. It is unbelievable. Like usually a pizza steel, you have to heat it up for like 30 minutes in the oven and then put the dough on it and then put the dough in the oven. And you don't need to do any of that. And because it's hex clad, nothing sticks to it. It's like, this is one of those, it's a sleeper product that I really didn't think it was just going to be, it was going to be such a big deal. And it's only an individual product, but I think it's going to crush for us. And we're already seeing, like we offered it to the group, to our Facebook group, and people jumped all over it more than any other pre-launch, this one for some reason. And I was just like, what is the deal with a pizza steel? But apparently this is like a thing. And so it's, it was pretty fired up to see the reception on that one because it's a little bit different than just like another piece of cookware.
So are you selling it? You're only selling it solo by itself?
So at the moment, yes. But there will be some bundles of other things to go with it at some point. What, you have something in mind?
No, I'm just curious. I mean, you know, outdoor pizza ovens had a huge moment from like 2020 to 2022. I think they sold as many as they were going to sell. So it's interesting.
So what's nice about this actually, because I was kind of thinking the same thing as you, Sean, is that this is actually another piece of cookware to make pizza in your house, which is nice. I mean, I assume you can use it in a pizza oven too, but this is like, oh, I don't have a pizza oven. I don't. So this is the, you don't need to buy a pizza oven because you just need the Hexclad pizza steel to make awesome pizza in your home oven.
Yeah. And I think that's better because I don't, anyone who's going to buy a pizza oven has already bought one. And it's like, that's not that many people because you got to do it outside. It's a whole thing. This is, you know, I would love to cook up my DiGiorno on this bad boy. So that's more of of your core customer. That's more of who
I am. Dude, having a pizza oven is a lot of work. I got a pizza oven from Crew Ovens. It's awesome. I love this thing, but it's like a real commitment to making a pizza. Like, you got to get the wood, you got to fire it up, you got to get it hot, you got to keep it hot. It's actually a lot more work than you think it is to use one of these pizza ovens. Their oven is awesome. It works great. It's beautiful. I'm actually going to build a stone platform for it at my house during the renovation, because I love it so much. But it's kind of like Traeger, you know, like Traeger. They were crushing it during the pandemic. Everyone wanted a Traeger grill. And now you don't really hear about Traeger that much anymore. I don't know. Do you, Sean?
No, Traeger, Weber, the whole outdoor industry is fucked. And I totally agree that, dude, you buy a pizza oven, you're going to use it 3 times, one summer, and then it's just going to sit in your garage. So this is a way more useful tool, and I'm excited that people are loving it.
Look, I got to talk about Fulfill for a second. So, you know, one of the things when you have sponsors on a pod is there's always this question of like, how genuine is that, is the recommendation, right? I've actually personally sent them to people that are looking for a solution. So I sent them over to Fulfill. I made the introduction. I've been pleasantly, not surprised, because I know the reputation, but it was like, it's been nice to hear from those guys that I sent to Fulfill. They're actually having a really good experience. So it's kind of cool as a podcast host to have a sponsor be living up to the endorsement. So shout out to Fulfill today. Jason, are you guys measuring, like, at your size now, are you measuring like American brand awareness? Like, I don't know what it's called, but you can do these like studies where you actually see how many people are aware of Hexclad, like per house, like per.
No, and it's something we have to do. And Matt, thanks for pointing that out, because we were just talking offline about the fact that we run these events now. Like, we ran a big event at South Beach Food and Wine Festival a couple of weeks ago. It was a lot of fun. And we've done it a couple of years in a row. And it used to be that not a lot of people knew us. And now a lot of people know us. Like, we had chefs who we don't even work with come over and hang out behind our booth and talk to our customers, like, or our prospects. It was crazy. And so it's like, the question is, you know, how does that make you feel when we as marketers, we're trying to get to people, we're trying to reach people. And if you look at what all the big public retail companies say, like, what their number one future growth driver is, it's increased brand awareness. They always talk about brand awareness or geography, but brand awareness usually comes first. And it's like, wait a minute, where do you get to how do you get to that point where, wow, okay, the brand awareness has happened? So I'm not sure where to look at that, Matt, but that's interesting. I definitely would like to brush up on that.
There's, we just did one of these, by the way. We just got we do it biannually, and we do both aided and unaided awareness. And then we look at a bunch of competitors, and it's pretty interesting.
Mike, can you expand on that? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. So basically we contracted with a firm that does this kind of thing. I can't remember the sample size. I think it's a few thousand people. And so it allows you to get a feel for what your brand penetration, exactly what you're talking about, Jason, just how quickly are you kind of increasing your brand penetration. Aided means that if somebody says, hey, have you heard of Hexclad? Then they would say, oh, yes, I've heard of Hexclad, or no, I haven't. That's aided awareness. Unaided awareness is, hey, name some people that make pots and pans. And do they name Hexclad as one of the people? So the bar on unaided is, I mean, unaided is really high. Like, that, to have really high unaided awareness is really rare, is basically what I've learned. And then aided awareness usually is quite a bit higher. So I don't remember what the gap is between us, but it might be 20 percentage points difference. But a couple of things that are worth pointing out here. The demographic piece of this really matters. So, for example, our brand, we're not trying to win over men 55 plus. It just doesn't matter if we have brand awareness functionally with that group, because they're not going to buy our product and our product isn't made for them. We're not marketing it to them. We're not trying to kind of in any way penetrate that group. And so when you ask somebody just kind of like, hey, what's your brand awareness? It's like on a really broad level, I don't think it matters. I think where it starts to matter is when you're breaking down into demographic groups that you really want to have penetration in. It matters, do you have aided or unaided awareness? And it matters, what's the trend line? Is that going up? How's that growing? And at what rate? And then also, what's going on with your competitors?
So that's interesting, but you know, they seem like really interesting data points to understand as a business. But how do you make them actionable?
Well, hopefully what you're doing is you're doing some behaviors and then you're trying to tie those to some quantitative outputs. So for example, to use something that we talked about earlier in an earlier episode, we did some stuff with billboards. So we might look at, hey, what is our aided and unaided awareness in the Oklahoma City metro area? And how did that change over the last 6 months? And then how does that compare to, say, Knoxville, Tennessee, or, you know, some other, like whatever, Dallas? And what do we do different in those markets? Is there, can we tie that to a behavior that we did? And because I think what you're getting to, Jason, is really the question that every marketer is constantly asking, which is causality. Can I attribute a change in the numbers, no matter how they change? Can I attribute that to some kind of action and then infer like what I need to do as a result to drive more of the behavior I want? So I'm a big fan of, you're creating benchmarks and baselines with numbers, and then you're running experiments and tests where you're treating different groups differently, and then looking at how their behavior changed and trying to decide what you did that was effective and what you did that wasn't.
So Jason, like, for you, I think the one that I'm asking is, I've probably sold, just personally, I bet you I've sold a dozen people on Hexclad just in my own house, right? And that's like, people come over, we're cooking, like we have people over all the time. We like to cook. That's just a thing. So like, people are constantly like, I've never seen that before. What is it? And I'll tell them. And then they go out and they eventually turn into a customer. So for me, there's two parts to this. So it's like, one, to go back to your original thing, how do you know, how do you measure, like, are you becoming a household brand? So like, Mike's hitting on a good point. That's baselines. You need to have baselines. Okay. So that's like one part of it. Then the action part is, how do you cut it up so that you can take action? So like, for you, I keep thinking it's a geography thing. You actually have a product that is in people's homes and is visible. That's such a massive leverage point as a brand. Like, Sean's is in somebody's back pocket.
Front pocket,
whatever. So like, it's not visible, right? Like, and I think that Sean's word of mouth is a lot harder to go after, and he can't do it any other way. Like, that's why they're so good at what they do, digital, all that stuff. Jason, your product is like literally on a fucking stove being used in front of people, whether it's in a restaurant or in a home. I feel like that's an important thing for Hexclad to actually get their head around, right? It's like, that data could tell you, like, you should just be spending 80% of your dollars in California. Like, I don't know, like a state where you just are like, you're almost at the tipping point. You could tip the state and never spend a dollar there again.
I think you're bringing up a good point, Matt, and I do not know the answer to this, which is, even once you know awareness, what do you do with it? So let's say that Jason could find out in California, his unaided awareness is 25%. Okay, in a vacuum, so what? Like, what does that number even mean? And I think that's where you have to tie it to other objectives and what you're trying to accomplish. So for example, some ways I might think about this, having really high brand awareness, I've always thought, can be a blessing or a curse. It can be a curse in the sense that, hey, if everybody knows who you are, then that means there's a lot less new customers hypothetically to tap into, unless you have a really massively long consideration cycle. If you had 90% brand awareness, then it's like, well, I'm not convinced there's a lot of customers out there that want to buy your thing that haven't bought it yet. But that might be fantastic for getting into complementary products or expanding your product portfolio, because you have a lot of people that are aware of what you have, and expanding might be good. And so I think it's a lot about how you're, I mean, this is Yeti's a really good example because they're a very known consumer brand. And we talked about, I think last week or a couple weeks ago, like when you think of coolers, you think of Yeti, right? Like they're probably the name, but cooler sales are down. They're going down. And so it's like they have really high aided and unaided a brand awareness, but they've also maybe penetrated all those people. So that's not necessarily a benefit. And that's one of the reasons why, just to your point, Jason, that you were making, I don't know if we caught it on air or not, but like when people say that they haven't heard of us, especially people in our demographic, I actually view that as a positive because I'm like, man, there's still meat on the bone. The moment that everybody's like, oh yeah, I know who you are, it feels like, man, how am I going to grow market share? Or how am I, or I'm going to have to convince people who already know who I am and know what I do, but are choosing not to buy me to buy me. So it all depends on how you apply the numbers to your business, I think.
Well, Mike, I'm the resident Yeti expert, and just I want to put some numbers down for everybody. Yeti reports on their unaided brand awareness, and in their heritage market, which is the Deep South, I think they top out at 20%. So they ask people and they say, hey, name cooler companies, and they get 1 in 5 people to say Yeti. That is like how hard it is to get unaided brand awareness, right? Like it is, we're dealing with most people won't know you. I think Mike made a good point about demographics. I tell people I work at Ridge, blank stares every single time until I pull out the wallet and they go, yeah, I think I saw that on Instagram. The only demographic that's not true is if I'm hanging out with like 19-year-olds who are chronically online, they have heard of it because of YouTube. So that is, demographics really matter here. And like the reason why it's good to use some sort of like broad test is so that you can get a large swath of society. Because if you just ask Twitter, everyone's heard of me on Twitter because that's where I spend all my time, right?
Now, so Jason, Sean, you just made a great point, and that was, you really answered my question. Well, it's like, what do you do when you know the numbers? But more importantly, your Yeti number, the 20%, it's like, we just shouldn't be worried at all at like our businesses. We shouldn't be worried at all about the fact that like we've reached everyone, because we haven't, like we and not at a level that's meaningful enough where there's unaided brand awareness. Like when you say, oh, leggings, people are going to say Lululemon, right? When you say soda, people are going to say Coke and Pepsi. But you know, we're nowhere near there. So just because we run into people at, and actually it's like, it's at a food event. Right? So like, of course, like I really shouldn't feel like we are tapping out in any way, shape or form at our size.
I think, Jason, to me, all of this game of consumer that we're playing comes down to how many customers do we each have? Like, Sean, what are you at? Like 4 million customers at this point? 5 million?
I think we've sold 5 million wallets, something like that.
Right. So like Pila Case, I think we're at 1.5. Lomi's at 200,000. Like these are small numbers. And Jason, I don't know what your total customer account is, like unique customer account at this point. But I think for a product like HexClad, that actually is an important number, because again, you're a household daily use product, and your comps for this stuff are like smart home companies, you know, Keurig, Nespresso, Roomba, Nest. Like all of these companies that like go into the home are visible, higher price point, like household penetration actually matters for a product like yours, in how you think about like, okay, if you're at 2 million customers or 3 million customers, how do you get to 30 or 40 million? Like that's where Keurig is. Keurig's at 40 million households.
Yeah. I mean, just to double click on that point, I'm probably out of the group. I'm the largest. We probably sold 30 million units, and we sold like 14 million last year. So like we're nominally, we're hitting a lot of people. But I think the point that Sean made is that he was saying even in the core of Yeti's core,
yeah,
geographically, their unaided is at 20%. And that's that. It should just be assumed that almost no matter what you do in consumer, like the vast majority of people will not have heard from you. And especially when you start to think about how big the world is and international, it's just like the number of people that have heard of you and that could pick you out of a lineup is always going to be in the minority. And to your point, Jason, the world's just really big, I think. And this is like anytime you start to get into like a scarcity mindset where, you know, you're obsessed with your competitors. This is one of the ways you stop obsessing about competitors is that when you're fixated on your competitors, it's like a fixed pie mindset of like, hey, you know, there's only so much and we're competing over it. And I've just come to see how big the world is and that there's so many customers out there that I need to spend a lot more time figuring out how to reach more customers and less time thinking about how to fight with a particular competitor.
Yeah, this is marketing gold here, guys. Seriously, this brand awareness and like what Matt just talked about with Keurig, and we can look at all of our businesses. You know, we think about it in terms of household penetration, and like we think there's around 20 million households for us, and we've probably penetrated about 10% of those right now. But maybe it is bigger. Right. And on the point about competitors, we don't think about competitors at all anymore, except for the fact that like every once in a while I'll get an ad and I'm like, oh, they launched this product. That's interesting. And I'll pass that on to the team. But we're like, I don't know if it's good or not. You know, there's always that disruptive company that could come out of nowhere, you know, the innovator's dilemma. But we don't even think about competitors at all.
If you're spending more than $1 million a year on paid ads, you probably have some amount of wasted spend. We all do. Marketing is the biggest line item on Ridge's P&L. So we spend more on marketing than we do on SaaS, people, or COGS. And 1% wasted spend can totally make or break a brand, right? And how do you determine if it's a channel messing up, or if it's an ad messing up, or if it's your team messing up? You need an independent source of truth there. So we recommend Northbeam multi-touch attribution. So what does that actually do? Facebook in platform wants you to spend more money on Facebook, right? They want to tell you that all of your sales are coming from Facebook. Google wants to say all of the sales are coming from Google, right? And you probably use Google Analytics, which is a last click attribution platform designed to make Google look better, right? So someone Googles your brand off of a Facebook ad, clicks a branded search term, who gets that sale? GA is going to say it's Google. Google Conversion Pixel is going to say it's Google. Facebook's going to say it's Facebook. How do you make sense out of that in this world? That's where Northbeam MTA comes in. A multi-touch attribution tool takes all of that data, all of their historical data, the billions in ad dollars that they've seen run through their pixel and their ad platform, and they determine the actual breakdown and who deserves the credit. So they got a team of data scientists from Stanford, Harvard, they got PhDs, and they've been working on this model for 6+ years. Pre-COVID, they were early movers in this space, and they know marketing attribution better than anybody else. Data is super flexible. They have more reports and metrics than any other platform out there. Over 450 you can choose from. I look at 5 and I use it to determine if I'm wasting money on different ad platforms. Do you think it's time to get on TikTok? Well, the best way to know that is to be able to compare TikTok versus a Facebook versus anything else. That's what Northbeam can do. And don't just take my word for it. Everyone on the podcast uses it. I've been on Northbeam. I was the very first customer 6+ years ago. Jason uses it. Dr. Squatch uses it, BlendJet, Reef Sandals, all 9-figure brands who love and use Northbeam every single day. So what are you waiting for? Get a demo, go to northbeam.io, click the link in the description, tell them the operator sent you, and we're here to help. So thank you so much, guys. Thank you for the support. If you're ready to check out and get to the next level of ad spend, check out Northbeam. Thank you. So Jason, I would ask you, how many household Costco memberships are there?
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I mean, I would guess it's 80 million memberships or more, right? So it's like, I think your TAM is even bigger. I just want to echo a point Mike said.
128 million Costco members.
Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, fuck it. All of them should buy Hexlad. That's my opinion. And I want to echo a point Mike had about the world being really big. I was looking at some music festival and there was some artist that I'd never heard of, not even headlining, like two or three down. I'm like, well, I'll look them up on Spotify. They had like 5 million monthly listeners, like a huge number. And I've never heard them before. Never heard a song, never heard their name mentioned. And look, I'm not fucking Mr. Pop Culture. I don't have my fucking finger on the pulse of everything. But that just shows you that there's 5 million people who love something that I've never heard of. And it's the same thing if you ever look at TV shows, like the most watched TV shows. People would be like, we were at Ridge Retreat. People were talking about the show Suits. I'm like, I've never heard of this. And they're like, dude, it 20 people told me how great it was. And it just shows you that like, oh, the world is so big that yeah, you can build a multi-billion dollar business and most people will just look at you blank eye like, yeah, I have no idea what that is. I think Coca-Cola has unaided brand awareness of like 65% because you're going to ask some people and they're going to say Pepsi. You're going to ask some people and they're going to say, oh, I don't like soda. I like Gatorade. It's really hard to get a monopoly on a market.
Well, in time, one other point, if we were going to turn this into a math equation, it would probably have something to do with units sold at times, you know, marketing dollars times time, just years. Coca-Cola has now been, what are they, 100 and something year company? And so there's part of that also. I was talking with somebody on my team, we were talking about the Stanley thing. And one of the observations I made, because it's, you know, I think it's interesting, even if you're not in drinkware, it's just been this kind of weird phenomenon. But to some extent, I think some of the reason why it was even possible is that they took a 100-something-year-old brand where there was a lot of familiarity with that brand kind of in the ether, so to speak, and just in the populace, and then they reinvented it. And I do think there is just a limit to how quickly you can really grow unaided brand awareness, because it just takes a while for a word to work itself into everybody's lexicon. One other concept that we talked about in an earlier episode, which is worth bringing back, is that I don't think brand awareness matters that much. I think brand affinity matters a ton. So there are lots of companies that I could say, hey, name an example of this, and you could, name an example of a mattress company. And you guys could be like, well, Casper or, you know, whatever. And we could name some and we would name a bunch of things that we wouldn't necessarily be buying and that aren't necessarily successful companies. So there is a gap. And for anybody listening to this, the most important thing isn't how many people know what you are. It's how many people are passionate about what you are. And that ends up driving sales, and that ends up being the core of building a really profitable business, is having raving customers, raving fans. So when I look at aided and unaided awareness, I want to zoom in on my demographics, because those are the people that might act on it. And then I want to know not just awareness, but I want to know affinity. And that will point towards probably how successful you're going to be in the future.
Mike, on your the world is big thing, the world is huge. Like what you and John, I agree, it's huge, right? This is why I it doesn't get talked about enough in our little bubble of D2C, but the world is massive. So shrink it. Like seriously, like if you look at how Keurig built, it's a monster business, right? They went state by state, city by city.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to like 7-10% household penetration. And then they pulled out and they moved their money to the next place on the board.
Yeah. And I think that can be really effective. That's a really practical question, I think. I think in a world where Meta is basically like, just tell us how much you want to spend and we're going to bring you customers, that it's like, in one sense, that's great because you're hitting your KPIs. But in another sense, they're not necessarily using any organizing principle for where they're grouping those customers, and getting to any kind of critical mass in a particular market may not be happening. And where that really matters is if there's any kind of network effects, if there's any kind of desire to build up a base somewhere so that you can establish a foothold in physical retail, then just giving your money to Meta and saying, hey, spend it efficiently might not be the best way to do it. And Keurig is a product that has, you know, physical retail matters, for example. So it makes a lot of sense to say we're going to win markets and we're just going to progressively work our way through markets. I think that makes a ton of sense. And for us, we've started with, listen, we have to win the Oklahoma City market. And if we don't win the Oklahoma City market, there's no way we can win any market. So we've just kind of started here.
Dude, you're hitting on a funny point. Sean, I don't know if you've thought about this, but like, Mike, what you just said is, it kind of makes my skin crawl a bit, because Meta is an incredible platform. Like, it has made all of us, it's gotten all of us to here. Maybe Mike, less you, but like for sure, Sean, Jason, and I, like Meta's been a big part of what's built our companies and hundreds and thousands of other brands. But if you never reach any kind of, like as a consumer product, if you never reach any kind of critical household penetration percentage in any local market, you are spending money on Meta forever. Like forever. You have to rely on it to go find you customers. Whereas if you're a product with a big enough TAM that's widely used, I don't know, let's say a pan of some kind as an example for today's podcast, let's just use pans. If you're used in every fucking house in the world, yeah, your TAM is massive and household penetration matters a lot. And allowing Meta to be the thing that's constantly picking off where you go, maybe isn't the most efficient way long-term. Maybe short-term, it makes a ton of sense. I have no idea. All I know is that before Meta, consumer companies existed and they got very big before Meta.
And they got big regionally. They built regionally, historically. It was like you built in the city, kind of in, you started in, and then you gradually, you got, you know, local distribution, and then you got regional distribution, and then you went national. And obviously that's totally gotten turned on its head with digital.
Well, HexClad's about to take over New York City, because we did a deal with a very famous sports team there. I'm not going to name any names yet, but...
You have three guesses.
Yeah. It better not be the Brooklyn Nets.
Even I know that.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, I want to add 2 points to this. The first is, you know, every additional ring of customers you add is harder, right? So like your core customer, like at the very center of the tree, the center target is very easy to convert. And everyone outside of that gets a little bit harder. And what you guys are saying is that by focusing on a national scale, you have less of a network effect to attract the next ring of customers. Like if I just wanted to go after, I'm going to say Detroit, right? Easiest customers, whatever, like they'll help convert the next round of customers just by based on proximity. You can do better targeting, whatever else. And then you can move to Chicago, right? And you can restart that process with the center ring of customers. Because all of our tools are digital and national and open targeting, you're converting the next ring all at the same time. And that's, it can be done. I mean, Ridge has done that, right? I think all of us have done that. It's just way more expensive and you end up investing way more in MER. The second point I just want to talk about is, this is why consumer companies suck so much. Google has 90% market share. Uber has 80% market share, right? Like commodity digital goods, like Facebook has 100% market share, right? For customers, like for social media. These utility goods, it's kind of like, does electricity have 100% market share? It's like, of course, everyone likes electricity, right? But consumer goods, like we're arguing and fighting about getting 10%, 20%, 30%, because that's the max any consumer company could ever get. So just something to be aware of when you're building a consumer. It's hard because of personal taste and choice, and you will never get 100% of a market. And even best in class Coca-Cola or Lululemon, they're getting 50% market share or whatever. So,
yeah, I think type of product matters a lot here. Like whether it's a, and I think in D2C, especially if you're on Twitter, most people that are talking are like building very niche down products and brands, right? Like maybe they get to $100 million. Jason, you and Mike, like you just happen to be in the categories. The TAM is so big, right? That like what you guys are able to do is go after 50 million households. Most brands can't do that. So I think, Sean, I agree. I just think it's very category specific.
Right. But Mike's never going to have 100% market share of water bottles.
Never. Like, no. No. Like, no, it's actually a great point. Like, no consumer company ever gets to, well, unless you're Bic, I guess maybe they have like 90% market share in pens, right, John? That's the best brand ever.
In water bottles, it's crazy. Yeti might have the number one unit market share. They did a couple years ago and it was less than 10%. It's just an insanely fragmented market. And so it's fascinating in that respect. But I do think there's an interesting question that you kind of alluded to earlier, Matt, which is just how do you start to create some kind of a flywheel, some kind of network effects, something that begets organic demand so that you're not 100% dependent on the digital gatekeepers for new customers all the time. And I think that looks different depending on your TAM, but it's an important question every brand needs to ask, because Sean's talked about this. Like, listen, CPMs, they're going up. It's like Bitcoin. Bitcoin is going to go up because there's just a limited amount. There's more and more people. And just over time, like it's just going to go up. You know, I'm of that opinion. It's the same thing with CPMs. Like, there's a limited number of eyeballs and there's going to be more and more people that want to get in on that. And over time, the demand and the market price of those is just going to keep going up. And so I feel like it's incumbent on every single brand that does anything digitally. You got to have some kind of a plan of how you're generating some organic demand, some network effects, some kind of walk-up traffic. If you're just 100% dependent on Google and Facebook and whatever else, like, man, it just feels like it's a countdown to when you can't pay the market price anymore.
I'll be really honest with you. The cost savings is probably the biggest driver for me. I think I'm going to save like over $100,000 a year switching. And there is nothing I would not do to save $100,000 on SaaS. Like, the whatever the darkest thing you're thinking, yeah, that's me trying to save money on SaaS. So that's a big driver. And look, I believe in the product. I've seen it. I've seen the demos. People are like, oh, isn't migration going to be a pain in the ass? Yes. That is why I did not migrate in Q4. It's never going to be painless to do one of these things, right? Like, I've been on Klaviyo for 10 years. It's going to take some time and effort to put it in, but Jimmy is the type of guy who's committed to make it as seamless as possible. So I'm very, very excited to switch to SendLane. They're a startup, man. I think their culture matches mine. I'm excited to be there. So Photoshop a SendLane logo on my jersey, because that's where I'm going, guys.
Love it. You know, I was on a call. I'm happy we're talking about this, because I had a call a few weeks ago. Ex-president of Keurig, right? Took the company from like a few hundred million to several billion, talking just about marketing dollars and customer acquisition, all of it, just trade dollars. And what they said to me was hilarious. They're like, if you went out right now and spent $100 million on advertising, I'm still going to tell you that it's not enough to make a dent in a national level in the United States. Like, they were just like, you're pissing in the wind. $100 million in ad spend, you're not making a dent. Doesn't matter where you spend it. TV, Facebook, like $100 million to 350 million people on a CPM basis, it's not that much. When you have to consider like number of impressions, how often does somebody need to see you across how many places, like nobody in our network is spending at a scale that on a national basis should be effective. Now, the hack to all this is, well, if you're really fucking good at meta, you can make it somewhat effective. Case in point, Ridge, like you're trying to spend $100 million this year, right? But on a household basis, like from a brand building, like, can you walk around the street and find on a street of 100 people, can you find 10 people that have heard of you? It's tough to do nationally. It takes time.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And, you know, no one is happy with the presidential candidates this year, right? Like,
yeah.
across the board, it's going to be Trump versus Biden. Everyone is pissed off on both sides. But no one else can challenge them because of name recognition. It's because both of them have spent 20 plus years and billions of dollars at this point, just getting name recognition. And love him or hate him, like if you know him, it's easier to get votes for the person who has name recognition than just the nameless person you've never heard of before.
And specifically, it's name recognition with certain demographics, particularly boomers, right? Like it doesn't matter if Trump has great name recognition of 20 to 25 year old males. I mean, he does, but it doesn't really matter. For an election in this country winning it, you've got to be able to have great name recognition in people 45 and above. And this is more or less what's dominated US politics. This is why we keep getting people that are older and older and older, is that we got one massive glut of a generation that's kind of controlled voting for several decades, and in the boomers, and they still are controlling it. And so we shouldn't be surprised that you've got a couple of boomers that are the two candidates, even though I don't know that either of those guys know exactly fully what's going on these days. And so the demographic thing really matters. Your product market fit with a particular demographic ends up being a bunch of the game.
Right. So to tie it back to Matt's point, it's that on Meta, there's incremental revenue capture across the board. I spend $100 million, I'll capture a couple hundred million dollars in sales. But at the end of the day, if I wanted to reach everybody in America and get them to know who I am, it's probably $10 per daily active user. That's what you have to spend. It's like to have enough meaningful impressions. So it's $3.5 billion. And the reason why this matters so much, it doesn't really matter for consumer brands because we have incremental ROAS along the way, right? You do this for 20 years or 50 years, eventually you spend enough money, you reach all of these people. But it really matters for elections, and it's why election spending is so insane, because there is no incremental ROAS. It's like you have to get enough market share quickly enough. And that's what leads to this polarization in politics. Not to throw us down that rabbit hole, but
No, it's the spend level's interesting though, right? Like 2020 elections, I just looked up it. $6.6 billion.
Yeah.
Spend is
going exponential in these races, but the research they've done is that you basically don't move votes. And so like there have been some interesting examples where they'll take a market, like Iowa, for example. Somebody did this with the Iowa caucuses, and they were like, you know, whatever, 3 months before the caucuses, they said how many undecided people are there, you know, according to polling. And it was like, you know, in Iowa, I don't know, there's like 10 people in Iowa. So there were, anyway, they took the undecided people, and it was not that many people. I mean, it was like 10,000 people in the entire state that would describe themselves as undecided. And then they looked at how much money was spent, and it was like just something insane. It was like that you ended up having $50,000 per undecided voter being spent, or some kind of crazy amount. And the number of undecided voters wasn't even enough to really move the needle anyway. So the spending is out of control. And as we're all going to see as we get in later into this year, it's really going to be disruptive to CPAs and CPMs for digital brands, because you've got to compete with that. And this goes back to the point I was making earlier. It's like, it's an open marketplace. The CPM is just based on all the people that want to advertise. And oh, by the way, guess who's coming back? Sean's made this point. The crypto money boys, it's freaking coming. And all of those crypto scams and NFT ads and all that stuff, oh, it's coming back, baby, because Bitcoin's at like 70K. So get ready. You got political money, you got the freaking Ethereum Bitcoin money, and it's not going to be cheap to advertise this year.
Yeah.
Sell.
No.
Yeah. Thanks for the good news, Mike.
Yeah, sorry to be the bearer of bad news, guys, but it doesn't set up to be a banner year if you're looking at Meta CPMs. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm wrong about all kinds of stuff.
October 2020, definitely. September, October 2020 were bad for us.
CPMs were insane.
For sure. They were bad.
I remember that. So, that was painful.
But we're going to learn from our mistakes. I don't know what the learnings are yet, but we're going to figure it out.
I'm going to go on holiday in September and October, and I'm just going to shut shit off, and I'll see you guys in November. So that's my strategy.
I'm not that worried about political ad spend pumping into the ecosystem, because like Chinese ad spend last year was $4 billion. That was net new money added to Meta. So it's probably the same amount as that. And we survived.
As long as the Chinese ad spend dries up, yeah, it could offset.
And the beauty of political.
I mean, Temu spent you know, just that they can't be sustainable, right? They can't sustainably spend that much money.
Chinese advertisers?
Well, particularly, yeah, Temu. I mean, what do you think?
Temu spent like 1.8 on Meta, something like that, $1.8 billion, which everyone's freaking out about. You know, they did four Super Bowl ads. So that's $20 million or whatever. It's like, yeah, okay,
guys, that's nothing compared to what they're doing on Meta.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think it's sustainable. So I think it goes away and I think it's replaced by political ads. But the beauty of political ads is that the elections make people spend a lot of time on the internet just fighting with each other, and they'll get HexClad ads, they'll get Ridge Wallet ads, and hopefully they'll
drives up the number of impressions. One thing that a realtor told me once, which, you know, I don't know, this is just kind of secondhand, but he said when it comes to buying and selling homes, he said that the activity just dies right before an election because people a lot of times wait for an election to make a decision about what they want to do, which I thought was interesting. I wouldn't necessarily think if I was wanting to buy or sell a house that I would wait and see which way an election would go. But he said, at least in his experience, it'd been pretty common.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Also, like the markets for like 3 months leading into it will kind of freeze up.
Tread water, yeah.
But Jason, you got a panzerism?
Yeah, I got a good one actually for today. I'll do it quick too because I know we're running short on time. But so I was thinking about failure because there's been a lot of stuff in the chat. You know, certain of you guys are obsessed with Thrasio and their bankruptcy and just thinking about failure in general. I think this is a good one for everyone. And it comes from the fact that I've become obsessed with golf, as we all know. And golf is all about, like, how do you deal with bad shots? You know, basically, guys, failure doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. And when you like shift your mindset into that and say to yourself, no, failure doesn't exist. You know, people can even go bankrupt, right? But they learn from that. So everything is an opportunity to learn. And so, I mean, I think it's really simple, but I just felt like I had to say it to people. Like, some people need to hear it. Like, the market is tough right now. There are tons of people trying to start businesses or struggling with their current business. And it's like, yeah, it's hard. It's always hard. You know, I think I mentioned on another pod that we met this really senior banker, commercial banker at JP Morgan. And it's like, HexClad is in like the 99% like of success, like so many. Like, people never got anywhere near this. But all of those missteps or quote failures, they're not really failures. They're learning experiences. So I think you just got to have that. Failure doesn't exist mentality when you're down. And it's like, it happened to me on the golf course. It's like, I had a par bogey, and then I had two triple bogeys in a row. And like, I started off so strong, I'm playing great. I'm like, you know what? Okay, but those are not failures. That's just learning from the mistakes that I just made. And yeah, I just thought that I would mention that one today. Failure does not exist.
All right. Well, I'm going to push back. I think failure totally does exist, but it just doesn't matter all that much. It's like, I think particularly the bankruptcy thing, it's like, yeah, you failed, but I don't judge you for it. That's the way I look at it. It's just like, people treat failure as this ultimate like black mark against them. Like, man, fuck it. Try it again. So,
well, that's the thing. There's all these entrepreneurs that failed and failed and failed, and then they figured it out, right? Even like Danny and Cole, when they started HexCloud, they started doing something totally different, and it was a great idea and it failed. But they managed to pivot, and it's back to their roots in cookware. But like, so was that really a failure, or did they just learn a ton from it to be successful with the next product?
So I'll take a middle path. I think when you allow something, let's say something where the results don't go the way you want them to, that's what we're talking about, right? Whatever word you put on that. And I think there's two different ways it can go. I did this thing. I wanted it to go like this. It didn't. And I didn't really learn anything from it. And it just sucked. And I'm sad. The end. That, I think, is what failure looks like. The other possibility is, I went after this thing. I wanted it to go like this, but it didn't. But I learned all these things. And I took something from that. And so it wasn't just this pointless exercise, but I actually, that experience taught me a lot of things, changed me as a person. And as a result, I'm a stronger person. I'm a smarter person coming out of that. I'm a more effective person. Then to me, that's success. And I think that that's the difference between effective and successful people and the people that are constantly telling you about how they've just had all the bad breaks, is that effective and successful people don't let their circumstances dictate their future. No matter what circumstances they get, they take them, they learn from them, they adapt to them, they learn how to take those and turn them into opportunities. And then there's people who just like, when circumstances don't go their way, they just get mad. They pout, they quit, they get frustrated, they withdraw. And I think that is what failure looks like. So I'm kind of in between, and I try and take a mistakes, failure is tuition kind of mindset. And that, I mean, even this week, we've had some stuff that just with our team where we botched a couple things. And it's like, well, hey, if we aren't using that experience to be a better team, then that is a failure. If we can take that and we can harness it, we can learn from it, we can be better, we can raise the bar, we can put in better processes, whatever, then okay, then we got something out of that. And in one sense, it was a success and it built a better company. So I think a lot of it is what you do with it when your circumstances, when the results don't match what you're hoping for.
Hell yeah, I like dude. It. Sorry for hijacking your Panzerism of the week, Jason.
No, man, but I love it. That's the point. The point is to think about it. And I think everybody, there's a spectrum of views and approaches to it, but I think both of you make really great points.
If anyone ever tells you, like, yeah, I failed, but I learned something, ask them tangibly what they learned and just make them prove to you that they learned something. Because so
even
often,
further, ask them how they're applying that, right? Because it's one thing to be like, oh, yeah, I learned from it. And you're like, okay, how are you living your life different? And if they can't point to something, then it's like, did you really learn anything? I'm not sure you did, bro.
I think it's, you know, it's a platitude people like to say. Like, well,
it's really
I
like a mindset, though. I mean, I think about it. This is really more of, I think you should take that mindset when you fail, and that will force you to try to learn from it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, the best things that have happened to me have usually been things not going my way. Because the reality is, we as human beings do not like change. And we will usually not change unless we're forced to. And sometimes we need to change. Sometimes there's things in our character, how we're approaching business, how we're treating people, where we need to change. And if things continue to go great, we're not going to do that. We're just going to keep doing what we want to do, what feels comfortable. And so things not going our way, circumstances not working out, sometimes can be a wake-up call that, hey, it's time to look inward. It's time to figure out how I need to change. And so for sure, I would say I've had two or three major ones in my life, like turning points in my life where the catalyst was something really not working out. And it caused me to be more introspective, and it caused me to be willing to make a change that I wouldn't have been willing to make if things were just going great.
Yeah, if you're not growing, you're decaying. You gotta keep changing.
All right, is that a wrap, boys?
Let's wrap it.
Yeah, good talking, gentlemen.
Episode 46 of the Operators Podcast in the books. I'm sick. Jason's here. Mike's here. Matt was here. We're going to let it wrap right there, guys. Thank you to Fulfill, Sendlane, Northbeam, three softwares I use every single day. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for making us the number one podcast on earth. Take that, Joe Rogan. Talk to you guys later. Bye.